From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis, host for this special edition of Press Conference USA. Well, here in the U.S., we mark February as Black History Month. It is a time for paying tribute to the generations of African Americans who struggled with and overcame adversity to reach numerous accomplishments and achievements and contributions that have played a central role in U.S. history. The celebration of Black History Month began as Negro History Week, which was created in 1926 by Carter G. Woodson, a noted African-American historian and publisher. It became a month-long celebration in 1976. Well, the month of February was chosen to coincide with the birthdays of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. Some notable and famously known African-American contributors to our history include scientist George Washington Carver. He developed 300 derivative products from peanuts, among them cheese, milk, coffee, flour, ink, dyes, plastics, wood stains, soap, linoleum, medicinal oils, and cosmetics. Harriet Tubman, another famously known African American, is said to have led over 300 slaves to freedom through the Underground Railroad before the Civil War. More recent notable African Americans include a person I had the pleasure of interviewing about 15 years ago, Shirley Chisholm, the first African American woman to be elected to the House of Representatives, and she was the first female candidate for President of the United States. Well, the self-made millionaire, Madam C.J. Walker, she was born on a cotton plantation in Louisiana and became wealthy after inventing a line of African-American hair care products. She established Madam C.J. Walker Laboratories and was known for her philanthropy. And Robert Johnson, he became the first African-American billionaire when he sold the cable station he founded, Black Entertainment Television, known as BET, in 2001. Well, those were just a tiny fraction of notable African-Americans who have made history, but there is a part of U.S. history that people know little about, and it starts right here in the nation's capital. Joining me to give us insight into one aspect of little-known African-American history is journalist, author, TV personality, and educator Jesse Holland. Among some of his many contributions, Mr. Holland was one of the first African-American journalists assigned to cover the Supreme Court full-time, and only the second African-American editor of the Daily Mississippian, the college newspaper of the University of Mississippi, and he is also a distinguished scholar in residence at the Library of Congress. Also joining me on the panel today is VOA senior TV correspondent Chris Simpkins. Chris specializes in coverage of African-American issues, and he did an amazing series here at VOA to mark the 400th anniversary of the landing of the first enslaved Africans in Virginia. It was entitled Retracing the Paths of the First Slaves in Virginia in 1619. Well, welcome to you both. And Mr. Holland, I had the pleasure of meeting you and interviewing you about 11 years ago when I did a radio report on your book, Black Men Built the Capitol. Well, I have it here with me, and it was signed by you on April 14th, 2009. I recently reread the book because it is just one of those books you can read over and over again and still learn something new. In the preface of your book, you talk about how people come to Washington to see the monuments and famous buildings, such as the National Mall, the U.S. Capitol, the White House, and of course the museums and memorials. Why is there such little information on the history behind these buildings when what you found was history deep with richness and drama, so compelling that it makes art imitate life?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on today. It's great to see you again after all this time, and I appreciate that you actually still have a copy of my book.
Yes.
It's not sitting, you didn't resell it on Amazon or anything.
No.
You actually still have it, so
no, I'm
thank you.
It.
Well, I can tell you that I first moved to Washington in 2000, and I did what most tourists do. I went straight to the National Mall because I wanted to see the Capitol, the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Memorial, the White House. But when you go straight to the National Mall, you would think that African Americans never lived in Washington, D.C. When people talk about African American history in Washington, D.C., they talk about Anacostia, they talk about U Street, they talk about Frederick Douglass. But none of those places and none of those people were on the National Mall. So unless you made an effort to leave the center of the city, you would never know that black people ever lived in Washington. Even though it doesn't like to be, Washington is a southern city. And we know that there's no southern city that African Americans did not influence. So I wanted to know, what was the influence of African Americans on the National Mall? It had to be there. But when I first moved here to Washington, there was nothing on the National Mall that indicated African Americans ever lived in the city. I mean, there was the one soldier, African American soldier, on the Vietnam War Memorial, and that was just about it. The only other indication of African Americans that you could even find on the National Mall was the bust of Martin Luther King Jr. in the Capitol Rotunda. And you had to go inside the Capitol to see that. But I knew there had to be a greater story. There had to be evidence. There had to be stories of African Americans on the National Mall. And I set out to find those stories, and I did.
Great. That's good. And Chris, did you want to, I know you had to do a lot of research for your production that aired over the summer. What did you find?
Absolutely. And doing research on these topics is not easy. The information is not that available. You really have to dig deep and talk to people. There's a lot of oral history involved in this. So it's a very complicated issue to try to tell with the research. So my hat's off to you, Jesse, for doing that.
And also, Jesse, the title of your book, Black Men Built the Capitol. So let's just start there.
Right.
What do we know about African Americans who built the Capitol of the U.S.? And what are some facts that we don't know about the people that built the Capitol?
Well, one of the first things we have to acknowledge is that up until the Civil War, slavery was legal in Washington, D.C. So not only was Virginia a slave state, not only was Maryland a slave state, but so was Washington, D.C. So imagine you're putting together a brand new government and you need labor as cheaply as possible. How are you going to find it if you're in a slave state? You're going to find it by using slaves. So the federal government, when it came time to build the buildings that they needed in Washington, D.C., they turned to the slave owners in Washington, D.C., Virginia, and Maryland, and started renting slaves. Now, throughout all of the years of the research that we've done, and I'm not the only person who've been doing this research, there's other great writers and great researchers and historians who also have been doing this, but no one has ever found evidence of the federal government itself ever owning slaves. But what they did was they went to slave owners and they rented the slaves from them and paid the slave owners for the work of the enslaved. So buildings like the U.S. Capitol and the White House were constructed using slaves that were rented from slave owners in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. And those slaves were rented out to the government, paid just about, back in those days, $5 a day. And the only thing that the slave owners had to provide to the federal government was the slave and a blanket. The federal government itself handled everything else. So the federal government built shelters for them. The federal government fed them. And, you know, the federal government used them to build those buildings that we look at today. Even today, it's very little information out there where the public can see it that acknowledges the fact that those slaves were used in the construction of the U.S. Capitol.
And also what I find fascinating, and we kind of mentioned this earlier, Chris, was where did they learn their skills from? I mean, they had to know carpentry, welding, design, you know, looking at the drawings and everything. So where did they learn all of this, Chris?
Well, they had these skills from when they came from Africa, places like Angola and places like Ghana. We were taught in history lessons that when enslaved people arrived in what would become the United States, it was a blank slate. They had no skills. That could be further from the truth. They had incredible skills, and it shows in this beautiful building, which I must say is the most beautiful building in Washington. We often take the Capitol for granted, but as a resident of the District of Columbia, I look out at this beautiful building and see the sunset glistening off of it, and I just imagine that the skills that were brought to bear to construct this building.
And one of the things we have to keep in mind as well is that the Capitol wasn't the first building they built. All of these mansions and plantations we see in the Washington, D.C., greater Washington, D.C. area, those slaves constructed those buildings as well. So over the years, they built up the skills that they used to build the federal government buildings like the Capitol and the White House. Now, I want to be clear about this. We're not saying that those slaves designed these buildings, because people like James Hoban, they had competitions for the design of the building. But the actual labor, pouring the marble, putting up the columns, building the building itself, the designers like James Hoban, they didn't do that. They instructed and they hired out slaves to actually do the construction. In fact, James Hoban is the man who was actually won the competition to build the White House. He was from South Carolina. He actually brought up three of his own slaves to work on the White House from South Carolina, and those slaves also worked on the construction of the Capitol. So you'd have slaves actually being used in the construction of both the Capitol and the White House, while, by the way, never getting one penny for their work. The slave owner got all of the money.
Wow, that's really something. Now, you mentioned that they really didn't do a lot of the designing of it. I recall way back in high school, I did this report on Benjamin Banneker, and he actually was an architect. So he was just so smart. He was a mathematician. He did a lot of designing of D.C. to confuse, like they say, the enemy. So that's why it appears that it's very confusing with all the streets.
Right. We're not saying in any shape, form, or fashion that African Americans did not have the skills, because Benjamin Banneker, Washington, D.C. wouldn't be what it is today without the efforts of Benjamin Banneker. But the slaves that were used to build the Capitol, we can see the designs to this day. It's in classic Greek architecture. They were not the ones who designed it, but they were the ones who actually put it together. Without their efforts, those buildings wouldn't be there today.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks for that point. Now, also, let's just look at the White House, and let's just go inside of the White House, and really I want to go to the kitchen. Because you talked about how the kitchen was a very important part of the White House, and I guess it still is. So can you tell us about the chefs there? And there was one particular chef who was a slave, but what happened with him?
Okay, well, it's one of those great stories about the White House. Well, first of all, the kitchen is always the most important room in any building.
House, right? Yeah.
Very rarely when I go to someone's house do I ever get past the kitchen. That's where we congregate. That's where we talk. So the kitchen was also a very important place in the White House. And in fact, the first president to actually live inside the White House was Thomas Jefferson. Now, John Adams was there for just a little bit before Jefferson took over, but the first president to live there permanently was Thomas Jefferson. So we all know that Thomas Jefferson was a huge fan of France. He loved France. He was the ambassador to France. He also had a relationship with some of his slaves, including a woman named Sally Hemings. So when Thomas Jefferson went to France, he actually took along Sally Hemings. So the whole time where Thomas Jefferson's the ambassador to France, Sally Hemings is in France with him this whole time. But not just Sally. He didn't only take Sally, he took Sally's brother, James. So the entire time he's in France, Thomas Jefferson has Sally Hemings and her older brother, James Hemings. So once they get over to France, Thomas Jefferson pays for James Hemings to learn French cuisine, because Jefferson knows he's eventually going back to Monticello, and he wants that same style of food back in America that he enjoyed in France. So while he's in France, James Hemings is being apprenticed to some of the greatest French chefs. So he becomes an absolutely fabulous French chef. But James Hemings is also one of the most trusted people in Thomas Jefferson's life. Trusted so much that when they actually arrived to France, Thomas Jefferson gave James Hemings money and a horse and told him to go ahead and secure lodgings in Paris for them. Now, from the second they arrived in France, both James Hemings and Sally Hemings were free, because slavery was illegal in France. So James Hemings could have taken that money and just vanished. And there would have been nothing Thomas Jefferson could have done about it. But Hemings did what he was asked. He secured lodgings, he stayed with Thomas Jefferson, and he learned French cuisine. So Jefferson, at the end of his ambassadorship, comes back to the United States. James Hemings has decided at this point, by the way, I'm free. I'm in France, I'm free. I don't actually have to go back to the United States with you to go back into slavery. So Thomas Jefferson makes him a deal. He says that, James, if you come back to Monticello with me, I will let you go. You'll be a free man in America. But in exchange, you have to teach someone else how to cook French cuisine. Because I spent all this money on you in France to learn how to cook French cuisine. If you just stay, I will have lost all this money. I want you to come back home and teach someone else. James agrees to this. So they go back to Monticello, and James actually teaches his brother, who is still enslaved by Thomas Jefferson, how to cook French cuisine. Once he's taught him how to cook French cuisine, James Hemings leaves. He leaves Monticello. He goes to Baltimore. Doesn't go very far. He goes to Baltimore. In Baltimore, he becomes a cook. Now, time goes on. Thomas Jefferson becomes president. And he is the first president to live in this new, wonderful building that they called at that time the Presidential Palace. And he has to staff this entire building because Congress does not provide any funds for a White House staff. So everyone that works in the building, Thomas Jefferson, has to pay. So he decides he wants a chef who knows how to prepare exquisite French cuisine. So he has one of his agents send a letter to who else but James Hemings, who is still in Baltimore. So Thomas Jefferson has an agent send a letter to James Hemings saying, James, will you please come back and be the chef at the White House? So James Hemings gets this letter and has a decision to make. I mean, this is a actual prestigious job, becoming the first White House chef.
And also, I'm going to have to stop you right there with this and leave us on the edge of our seats with suspense because we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Jesse Holland, journalist, TV personality, and author of Black Men Built the Capitol. Also in the studio with me is my colleague, Chris Simpkins, VOA senior TV correspondent. I'm Kim Lewis, and this is a reminder that our PC USA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And a new VOA English app for both Android and Apple devices has been developed, and we encourage you to download and use both. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook or at Carol Castiel, VOA. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@VOANews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Now, returning to our topic of discussion on the book by Jesse Holland, Black Men Built the Capitol, and let's finish up and hear more on this very suspenseful story.
So, James Hemings is contacted by Thomas Jefferson while he's a cook in Baltimore, with Jefferson asking him through an agent that Jefferson wants Hemings to come to the White House to become the first White House chef. Well, Hemings is not 100% sure he wants to be back around Jefferson. So keep in mind, this whole time, Jefferson is still holding his sister Sally as a slave. He's also still holding his brother that James Hemings had to instruct in how to cook French cuisine back at Monticello. So James Hemings wants his relationship with Jefferson clear before he goes back to the White House. So he sends a letter back through the agent asking Jefferson, well, how much you're going to pay me? How many people will work for me? What will be our relationship? He doesn't address the letter to the agent. He addresses the letter to Thomas Jefferson himself. Now, Thomas Jefferson is the newly minted president of the United States. So I suspect Jefferson was a bit confused why a cook in Baltimore expects a letter back from him. So Jefferson never replies. He actually sends a letter through the agent again, saying, well, James, you should come to the White House. James Hemings then insists that if Thomas Jefferson wants him in the White House, Jefferson should write him directly himself instead of through an agent. Well, Thomas Jefferson never does this. So James Hemings never actually becomes the first White House chef as Jefferson wants. He actually ends up staying in Baltimore where he's a cook until he dies. And Jefferson actually ends up hiring a Frenchman to become the first White House chef, which is why French cuisine is the unofficial food of the White House to this day. But it was James Hemings, the brother of Sally Hemings, who was supposed to be the first White House chef. But Jefferson would never address him as a man-to-man instead of through an agent. So their negotiations never were fruitful, and Hemings never became White House chef.
Interesting story. Now let's look at another aspect of African American history, and it's involving Freeman's Village. And I know both Jesse and you, Chris, as well, both have done a lot of research on this. So first of all, let's start with you, Chris. What have you found out with this?
Well, in 1863, thousands of newly freed slaves converged on Washington. So the government set aside land in Arlington, Virginia, just across the Potomac River, called Freeman's Village, as a camp for former slaves. There were hundreds of structures on this property, 100 wooden houses. The community had schools, churches, hospital, and even orphanages. And Jesse, for many historians, they say Freeman's Village was a place where people could find work and kind of transition to a new life of freedom in America. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, one of the interesting things about the origin of Freeman's Village is that it actually starts with Confederate General Robert E. Lee. So Arlington National Cemetery actually used to belong to Robert E. Lee. He married into President George Washington's family. His grandfather was George Washington Custis Lee. So Robert Lee was basically the great-grandson of George Washington and marries into his family. So he actually lives in Arlington House, which is the big pink mansion that sits over Arlington National Cemetery to this day. Well, when Lee becomes general of the Confederate forces, he can't live across the river from Washington, D.C. So he leaves and goes to Richmond. But he actually leaves his slaves behind, including one of his first slaves, a guy named James Parks. So the U.S. Army crosses the Potomac, probably looking for Lee before he leaves, but he has skedaddled. And the only people they find in Arlington House are the slaves. So they immediately say, okay, you guys are now free. But they don't want Robert Lee to come home. He's now leading the Confederate forces. So what they do is they get James Parks, who is the slave that was left behind, and they tell James to start digging graves in Arlington House's front yard, which is how Arlington National Cemetery gets started. Robert Lee's slave, James Parks, begins digging graves in the front yard to bury dead Union soldiers there. So Robert Lee, if he ever came home, would have to live in a cemetery. Now, in addition to this, the U.S. Army carves off part of the land and tells Parks and the other slaves left behind by Robert Lee that they can live there. And more freed slaves start joining them. Because at that time, the places for freed slaves to live were called contraband camps. Contraband camps are starting to pop up all around the Washington, D.C. area. In fact, there was one where the U.S. Supreme Court sits today. That was a site of a contraband camp. Also the site of the old U.S. Capitol. So those people who lived in these contraband camps begin filtering over to Freedman's Village. In addition, on top of all of that, African Americans who joined the U.S. Army were still segregated. So they couldn't live in the Army barracks that were in the Washington, D.C. area. So they had to live separately. And they lived on an island between Virginia and D.C. Those soldiers who lived on the island also moved into Freedman's Village. So after a few years, hundreds, if not thousands, of free African Americans are living in this city that's now Arlington National Cemetery. They're visited by people like Frederick Douglass, and they're actually joined by Sojourner Truth, who lives in Freedman's Village with them for a while. It was an actual town. Like Chris said, there were hospitals, there were churches, there were schools, there was an old age home, all in Freedman's Village. And none of it is there today.
What a fascinating story. Now, you mentioned Sojourner Truth. I guess before Rosa Parks, before Claudette Colvin, who both, you know, were very strong women who refused to give their seats up on the bus, there was Sojourner Truth. So tell us more about her.
When we look at people like Rosa Parks, in fact, there's a great exhibition at the Library of Congress right now about Rosa Parks. So if you have a chance to go see it, or you can go to it online, please go see it. It's wonderful. But what Rosa Parks did, she wasn't the first woman to do this. Actually, when Sojourner Truth moved to Washington, D.C., she lived in Freedman's Village, and she commuted from Freedman's Village, which is in Virginia, over to Washington, D.C. to work in Freedman's Hospital, which is now known as Howard University Hospital. So she rode public transportation in D.C., which were these trolleys, horse-drawn trolleys. And the trolley owners wanted to segregate the trolleys. Sojourner Truth did not believe in this segregation. So she gets on a trolley and she sits in front. Well, the trolley driver doesn't want Sojourner Truth sitting in front and tells her to get in the back. Now, the story should sound familiar to everyone by this point. She tells her to get into the back. And Sojourner Truth refuses. So the trolley driver physically picks her up and throws her off the trolley down onto the ground. Well, Sojourner Truth picks herself up, goes down to downtown D.C., and has the trolley driver arrested for assault and sues. So Sojourner Truth sues and wins. Sojourner Truth, after this lawsuit and this incident is over, said that the trolleys in Washington, D.C. looked like salt and pepper every day. There was no more discrimination in public transportation in Washington, D.C. And all of this is done while she's living in Freedman's Village.
Wow, that's fascinating. Chris, did you want to add anything to that story?
I wanted to go back to the Capitol, but...
That's what we just have. We don't have too much time, but yes, if you wanted to add something to
that. Yeah, I was just wanting to hear from you, Jesse. I was always impressed with the 6-meter-high Statue of Freedom,
right,
which sits atop of the Capitol Dome, placed there during the Civil War, and it was cast in bronze by a slave named Philip Reed. Tell us a little bit quickly about Philip Reed. I just was very interested in
Philip Reed's one of the great stories of the Capitol. I'll tell a story really quickly. So when they brought the plaster model of the Statue of Freedom to Washington, D.C., they actually set it up on the grounds outside so everyone could see it. Now, this plaster model is huge. So they put it together on the grounds of the Capitol. But once they had put it together, they couldn't figure out how to get it back apart without breaking it. So it sat there for months because nobody could figure out how to disassemble it and take it to a foundry to be bronze. There was only one person who could figure out how to do it, and that was Philip Reed. Philip Reed was able to puzzle out how to take this Statue of Freedom apart and get it to Bladensburg, Maryland, right up the road where they actually cast it in bronze. If you wanted to see that plaster model that Philip Reed worked on, it's actually in one of the newest areas of the Capitol today called Emancipation Hall. The U.S. Congress is one of the few agencies in Washington, D.C. that's actually acknowledged the work that slaves did in the construction of their building. So when they built the Capitol Visitor Center, the largest room in the Capitol Visitor Center, which is now the largest room in the whole Capitol complex, is called Emancipation Hall, after the slaves that were used to build the Capitol. And the plaster model that Philip Reed was able to figure out how to disassemble was moved from the basement of the Capitol to the middle of Emancipation Hall, where people can come see it today and remember the slaves that were used to make the building what it is now.
And how did he actually have it disassembled? What did he actually do?
Well, the plaster model had these connections on the inside, and they couldn't figure out, since it was so big, they couldn't figure out how to actually disassemble it without destroying the plaster. So he was able to figure out a pulley system and use some of the trees that are on the Capitol grounds to be able to lift parts of the statue up high enough where they could see inside it and disassemble it without breaking it. So he was able to solve an engineering puzzle. Keep in mind, this man was enslaved, but he was able to figure out an engineering puzzle that some of the finest minds in America at that time could not. He did it on his own and then helped helm the crew that actually bronzed the statue that is on top of the Capitol today. So when you look at the Capitol Dome and you look at that Statue of Freedom, it wouldn't be there without a man named Philip Reed. And if you want to see the actual plaster model he worked on, it's in Emancipation Hall.
Wow, that's really great. Another fantastic story.
There are so many great stories.
So many, and it's just too bad that we're running out of time, and we might have to have you come back.
Oh, I'd love to.
And do a part two, and you too, Chris, and just tell us more. This is really fascinating information. But, of course, we could go on with our discussion. As we mentioned, there's so many different facets to this subject, but we'll have to end on that note. I would like to thank our guest, Jesse Holland, for providing a very interesting insight into a small fragment segment of American history through contributions made here in Washington, D.C., and through his book, Black Men Built the Capitol. I also thank my colleague, VOA senior TV correspondent and producer of Retracing the Path of the First Slaves in Virginia, 1619, Chris Simpkins. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America is produced in Washington. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. I'm Kim Lewis, host of this special edition of PCUSA. Be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.